As I said, our half Torah portion comes from Jeremiah chapter 7, and starts with verse 21. Before we start reading the portion, let me just give you a little illustration before we look at the passage. What if someone came to you and they were starving? They were hungry. The one thing they needed was food. And you said, well, I certainly want to meet their needs. So what you give them is a new set of dishes. Would that accomplish anything? Would that satisfy their hunger? Not at all. In fact, it might even seem mockery. You give them a new set of dishes, and what they need is food. It doesn't make sense. Yet you know what? We do this all the time. We do this all the time. Now, on the other hand, if a person comes to you and they're starving and you've got a big pot of soup, delicious vegetable soup on your stove, and you want to give them a bowl of soup, you need some dishes to do that. You need bowls, you need a spoon, you need a saucer, whatever, because the dishes are the vehicle to minister life, but they are never a substitute for life. God has an appetite. He has a hunger. And the hunger he has is for the devotion of his people. And he's given us a way for us to serve that devotion to him. And the way we give him our lives and our devotion is through obedience to his word. The word is the vehicle. The word, the fulfillment of the commandments, those are the dishes. But what happens when you obey and you do the things that are said, but your heart is not in it? That's like giving a hungry person an empty bowl. The bowl is worthless if there's nothing in it. But the bowl is very necessary if it's a vehicle to give the food to the one who wants it. And this is what had happened to Israel. Their obedience to commandments had turned into just an empty form. Just an empty form. And look how it starts out in verse 21. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat flesh. Now, in our Torah portion from Leviticus chapter 6, 7, and 8, it describes how a burnt offering is to be done. Now, there are different kinds of offerings. There are thanksgiving offerings, there are meal offerings, there are peace offerings, there are whole burnt offerings, sin offerings, guilt offerings, there are others. There are other variations of these. Almost all of them are voluntary. There's only one or two that God says, well, this is what you have to do. But all the rest are simply a voluntary expression of love to God. But the whole burnt offering was the one offering that nobody ate. The entire animal was burnt on the altar. Nobody ate any part of that. All the rest, or most all the rest, the priest ate some, and you ate some yourself. You ate most of it yourself with your friends and family. But here God says, take your burnt offerings, just go and add them to your other sacrifices and eat them. In other words, I don't have any pleasure in it anymore. When you read in Leviticus, he says this whole burnt offering is a sweet savor in his nostrils. He smells it, and it just satisfies him. But you must understand, God does not derive joy from a juicy pot roast cooking. It's not the smell of the flesh that's pleasing to him. What he senses and what he satisfied is the spiritual heart behind the sacrifice. So he says it's a sweet smell to him. It's not the meat he's talking about. It's the heart of the sacrificer. This is why when he commands Abraham to offer his son Isaac on Mount Moriah, Abraham comes up, and with a willing heart, he's ready to obey, and he's ready to drive the knife into his son's heart or to cut his neck, however he was going to do it. God stopped him because it was not Abraham's son he wanted. It was Abraham's heart. And that was a sweet savor to the Lord. And he didn't have to have the actual sacrifice of his son. But for people just to do sacrifices, just to go through the form, is like giving a hungry person an empty bowl and telling them to eat up. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat flesh. It's just so much meat in his eyes. There's no heart behind it. There's no love behind it. There's no devotion to God. He has no dissatisfaction in him. So he says, it's just meat. You eat it yourselves. There's nothing in it for me. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. We're going to go back to this and look in a moment back in Exodus. But when God sent Moses into Egypt to call Israel, he simply said to them, you will be my people and I will be your God. You just obey me. Just hear my voice. He didn't mention anything about sacrifices. He then brings the Passover and brings them out of Egypt, brings them to Sinai. And he speaks to them through Moses, and he speaks to them from the mountain, and gives them the Ten Commandments. Still no word about sacrifices. And after they said, all you've said, we will hear and we will do. Then, after he gave his commandments, then he started to talk about sacrifices. That was later, because that was their heart response, a way of showing devotion back to God. So in the day he brought them out of Egypt, he didn't talk about sacrifices. That came later on. But this is what I commanded them, verse 23, saying, hear my voice. Now, if your translation says, obey my voice, your translation is trying to be helpful, because to hear God's voice means obedience. That's what it means. But make sure you have the literal word there in your translation. The literal word is, hear my voice. The Hebrew word for voice is kol. My voice is koli. The word for voices is kolot. But the word kol, K-O-L, is the Hebrew word for voice. And it's used a number of times in our half-Torah portion. He said, hear my voice, and I will be your God, and you will be my people, and you will walk in all the way which I command you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not hear, they did not listen or incline their ear, but walked in their own counsels and in the stubbornness of their evil heart, and went backward and not forward. You know, there's something I want to impress upon you, and I think you all know this, but I just want to make sure we all really get this. And I was in a conversation with somebody, I think it was this week, and we got to talking about this, and they were saying the same thing. Every commitment you ever make, every dream you ever have, every ambition you ever have, every project you ever set forth on, I don't care what it is, any endeavor you ever set forth on, will be tested. It will be tested. And it will incur pain. It will. That's a rule of the universe. How many of you have tried to play an instrument sometime in your life? All right, see all the hands? How many of you still play that instrument and do well at it? I don't see as many hands up. Somehow you died off. When the test came, the pain set in. I remember so well, I tried to play the violin once before I took up trombone. And because a trombone, you only need to use your arm. You know, that's all I got to do. A violin is too complicated. It sounded like I was torturing small animals when I played the violin. But I remember that the school started an orchestra. They had these violins and bass fiddles and all this stuff. And I thought, oh, man, this is great. And I'd open that box up, and there's this beautiful piece of woodwork. And oh, yeah, I just fell in love with this thing. I'm going to learn how to play this. I mean, I had all this ambition. I had this dream. And it died real quick. Because the test came. The test came, and I failed. Now, piano I did a little better at. But I can think of other things. And I'm sure you can, too, endeavors, whether it was art or music or sports or whatever. And the test came, the pain came, and you died. Just kind of, there's something, I hope this is not too inappropriate to read, but as I was thinking along these lines, I remembered something, I don't know who wrote this, but I dug it up. It's called The Exercise Diary. And this, you'll never forget this principle after I read this to you. Just sit back and enjoy this. For my birthday this year, my wife purchased for me a week of lessons at the local health club. though I still am in great shape for when I was on the varsity chess team in high school, I decided it was a good idea to go ahead and try it. I called and made reservations with someone named Tanya, who said she was a 26-year-old aerobics instructor and athletic clothing model. My wife seemed very pleased with how enthusiastic I was to get started. They suggested I keep an exercise diary to chart my progress. Day one, started the morning at 6 a.m. Tough to get up, but worth it when I got to the health club and Tanya was waiting for me. She's something of a goddess with blonde hair and a dazzling white smile. She showed me the machines and took my pulse after 5 minutes on the treadmill. She seemed a little alarmed that it was so high, but I think just standing next to her in that outfit of hers added about 10 points. I enjoyed watching the aerobics class. Tanya was very encouraging as I did my sit-ups, though my gut was already aching a little from holding it in the entire time I was talking to her. This is gonna be great. Day two. It took a whole pot of coffee to get me out of the door, but I made it. Tanya had me lie on my back and push this heavy iron bar up into the air. Then she put weights on it. My legs were a little wobbly on the treadmill, but I made it the full mile. Her smile made it all worthwhile. Day three. The only way I could brush my teeth was by laying the toothbrush on the counter and moving my mouth back and forth over. Driving was okay as long as I didn't try to steer. I parked on top of a Volkswagen. Tanya was a little impatient and said my screaming was bothering some of the club members. Day four. Tanya was waiting for me with her vampire teeth and full snarl. I can't help it I was a half hour late. It took me that long just to tie my shoes. She wanted me to lift dumbbells. Not a chance, Tanya. The word dumb must be in there for a reason. I hid in the men's room until she sent in Lars to get me out. For punishment, she had me try the rowing machine. It sank. Day five. I hate Tanya more than any human being on the planet. If there was any part of my body not in extreme pain, I would hit her with it. Day six. I got Tanya's message on my answer machine wondering where I am. I lacked the strength to use the TV remote, so I watched 11 hours of the Weather Channel. Day seven. Well, that's the week. Thank goodness it's over. Next time, I hope my wife gives me something more fun, like maybe a gift for a root canal. Does that sound familiar? Do you have ambitions to get in shape, stay on a diet? But when the pain came, how did you do? Everything gets tested. Because until it's tested, it's not genuine. And one of the things God promises he will test is always our faithfulness. Always our faithfulness. How many people do you know who are run hot and then run cold? They're here and they're on fire. I remember one man who stopped in here, it's probably been a year and a half or 2 years ago. He used to come when we met in our home. He came for a few weeks on fire and just disappeared. And then all of a sudden showed up 1 week and he says, I am back. He says, I've learned my lesson. I'm back. I haven't seen him for a year and a half. He came 1 week. I know people who are on fire for the Lord, but the moment their faith is tested, they crash and burn. And then they get so miserable, they think, well, I'm going to go back to the Lord. But it's tested, and they crash and burn. Now, I can look in this room, and I can see faith that's been tested and been proved the genuine article. But let me tell you a principle here. Until your faith is tested and passes the test, it's not faith. I'll say that again. Until your faith is tested and passes the test, it's not faith. That's the whole purpose of the test. Is this really faith or not? Or is it just wishful thinking? Is it just correct opinion? God tests everything. It's a principle of the universe. Anyone who succeeds at anything is because they went through the pain of the testing, whether it's business, sports, music, whatever it is. I remember, I forget who it was, someone who was fairly wealthy, and some young person talked to them and found out how much money they have and says, boy, you're lucky. And the man looked at him and says, well, there's something I've learned. The harder I work, the luckier I get. And so many times you look at people for success and think, well, they're lucky. But like the saying goes, success comes before work, only in the dictionary. God tests everything. The faith of Israel at this point in their history had been tested and they failed. Verse 24, yet they did not listen or incline their ear, but walked in their own counsels and in the stubbornness of their evil heart and went backward and not forward. Since the day that your fathers came out of the land of Egypt until this day, I have sent you all my servants and prophets daily rising early and sending them, yet they did not listen to me or incline their ear, but stiffened their neck. They did more evil than their fathers. Notice I keep talking about hearing. How does faith come? By hearing. If you have someone's ear, then you'll have their obedience. You shall speak, verse 27, you shall speak all these words to them, but they will not listen to you. He's talking to Jeremiah. Speak to them, they're not going to listen to you, but speak to them anyway. You shall call to them, but they will not answer you. You shall say to them, this is the nation that did not listen, there's the word listen again, hear, Shema, who did not listen to the voice, there's the word voice again, of the Lord their God. Or accept correction. The word there for correction is musar. It comes from the Hebrew word yasar, which means to chastise. You know how in Hebrews it talks about how God, the faithful Father, He chastises every faithful son. They did not accept musar, correction. Faithfulness has perished. Some translations may have truth. The word there is amuna. Faithfulness has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. Notice the four stages. A, they did not listen to the voice of the Lord their God. B, they didn't accept musar, correction, chastisement. C, faithfulness has perished. And then D, it has been cut off from their mouth. Since they're not hearing, it's not coming out of their mouth either. Hearing is where faith comes in. Speech, when someone, you know how James talks about if you can control the mouth, you can control the whole body. Speech represents fulfilling what you hear. If someone, if you hear, that's obedience. That obedience is expressed through speech, because when your mouth is under control, the whole man, the whole woman is under control. Verse 29, cut off your hair and cast it away. Because back in those days when you would mourn, you'd shave your head. And take up a lamentation on the bare heights. For the Lord has rejected and forsaken the generation of His wrath. Notice He's not saying He forsook Israel, but this generation. For the sons of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set up their detestable things, and the house which is called by my name to defile it. Now, of course, the house there is referring to the temple in Israel. Well, there's no temple today. So does it mean that it's impossible to defile the house that is called by God's name? Now, I've heard some pastors preach on this. They talk about the house being the church building. And to some degree, there may be some truth there, because there are some really wacko and wicked and sinful things going on in church buildings and synagogues. But I think the more accurate application of this is the fact that you are called a house. Each of us is a house. We are a tabernacle. And the question is, the tabernacle you inhabit is to be called by God's name, to be holy unto the Lord. And if you set up in your house detestable things to defile it, what are you putting into your body? What are you putting into your mind? What are you putting into your eyes and through your ears? What are the thoughts that you nurture in your mind in the dark recesses of your mind where no one else can see, but the Lord can, because He sees your thoughts? When you're just by yourself, what are the things you meditate upon? Are they things you'd like us all to see on that screen right there? Because I think someday they will be. Not just before your family, your friends, Beth Tikkun, but before the whole world, the whole universe. Hallows your house. Is it defiled? Can you go through the motions when people are watching? But inside your holy of holies, it's full of garbage. You know, that's a question. I'm not condemning anybody. I'm asking you a question, asking just a look in your own heart and answer it truthfully. 31. They have built the high places of Topheth. Topheth is interesting. It's a Hebrew word means spitting. Spitting. Why do you spit? Well, some people, you know, if you're playing baseball, you spit because that's what baseball players do. They just spit, you know. But generally, spitting is a useful action when you have something in your mouth that doesn't belong there. You know, you take a bite of something, you bite into something like, oh, that shouldn't be there. You spit it out. You don't swallow it, you spit it out. Spitting is a very useful action. But the things you spit out generally are meant to stay out because they do not belong in your temple. They do not belong in your house. They are detestable things. Yet they built high places of Topheth, of spitting, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom. The word Hinnom, by the way, means mourning, not mourning like mourning a.m., but mourning spelled with a U, you know, grieving. And also means to be sleepy, to be tired, to be kind of in the mood for a nap, to be falling asleep. To burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my heart. Therefore, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no longer be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom. This is Gehinnom they're referring to. But the valley of the slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth because there is no other place. The dead bodies of this people will be food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth, and no one will frighten them away. In the ancient Middle East, the worst thing you could do is to take a body out of a grave and just expose it to the sun out in public. That was the most detestable, demeaning thing you could ever do to someone, is to take their dead body and just lay it out to view and in the sun and let it rot. But you see what was happening. We've come full circle. God is hungry for a food that only we can provide, and that is devotion. It's love. It's a spiritual food he desires. And that food is served to him in something physical called the commandments. That's how we obey. That's how we serve to God. You know, can you imagine this? Let's say a young couple falls deeply in love with one another. They express their love to each other. They get married. And then they set up housekeeping. And this girl is so head over heels in love with her husband. Well, the husband comes home from work and the house is a mess. There's no supper on the stove. She's been home all day and says, well, honey, what have you been doing all day? Oh, I've just been sitting here all day just thinking how much I love you. I am so overcome with feelings of love and devotion to you, I just couldn't do anything today. So over time, the TV dinners pile up, the husband's making for himself, everything's covered with dust, there are hairballs on the floor, but the wife just sits over in a chair just with this glow on her face. She's so in love with her husband, she just can't concentrate on anything else. Well, that's what I call kind of a pretty useless love. In fact, I say it's a false love. I say it's just pure emotion. But you know what? There are a lot of believers who are like that. They just sit around and think God's pleased because they have all these warm feelings about him. Well, why don't you keep my Shabbat? Well, you know what? I just love you so much. I know you love me so much that it's just not important to do. It's just not that important. Because you know my heart. You see my heart, Lord, how much I love you. So here we are, we've got something God wants, but we can't give it to him because we have nothing to serve it in. The commandments, obedience to the word. Taking my body and conforming it to Scripture is the way I take the love and devotion I have and express it to God. Remember what we've always said here at Beth Tikkun. Every commandment is an opportunity to express love to God. It's the dishes we use to serve what's in us and give it to the Lord. But it's easy to give the Lord empty dishes or to have what he desires, truly have it, and not give it to him. Withhold it from him Because we think just feeling warm thoughts about our Creator is all He wants. Well, anyways, where did we leave off? I got sidetracked. We're down in, 33, the dead bodies of this people will be food for the birds. Oh, yes, I remember how I got off now. Back at the opening, in chapter 7, verse 21, God is desiring sacrifice that comes from a heart of devotion. But because they were not giving God what He's hungry for. Their sacrifices were just meat. He says, eat it yourself. Don't bother giving it to me. Just eat it yourself. And because they were not giving God what He was hungry for, look what happens to their bodies. Since they were not giving their heart and soul and their obedience to the Lord, then who does feed upon them? It says, verse 33, the dead bodies of this people will be food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth, and no one will frighten them away. There won't be anybody alive to shoo them away. Then I will make to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem. Here's the word voice again. There's a spider coming from the ceiling right here in front of me. I believe there's no coincidence, but I can't figure out why that's happening right now. There you go. All right. Okay. So we come to the word voice four times. The voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride. They're all silenced, for the land will become a ruin. Then we come to chapter 8. At that time, declares the Lord, they will bring out the bones of the kings of Judah and the bones of its princes and the bones of the priests and the bones of the prophets and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem from their graves. They will spread them out to the sun, the moon, and to all the hosts of heaven which they have loved and which they have served and which they have gone after and which they have sought and which they have worshipped. They will not be gathered or buried. They will be as dung on the face of the ground, and the death will be chosen rather than life by all the remnant that remains of this evil family that remains in all the places to which I have driven them, declares the Lord of hosts. I want you to get the picture here. Fire is the way, is the picture of the way where that which is physical is elevated to the spiritual. Let me say that again. Fire is the way that the physical is elevated to the spiritual. The word for offerings that you find all through the Torah is the word olah. The word olah means to go up. To go up. When someone goes up to read from the Torah, that's called an aliyah from the word olah, because they go up to the Torah. When someone moves from some country to Israel, they've made aliyah from the word olah, to go up to Israel. A sacrifice, you take this piece of flesh that was once a living animal, you put it on the heat of the altar, and the fire made it an ola, because it went up. And God says, that's a sweet savor in my nostrils. It brings pleasure to me. Not the meat, but the heart behind the one who gave it. Okay? It goes up. This is why Paul commands us to present our bodies as living sacrifices. In other words, living sacrifices. Don't be like these Buddhists who, I remember back in the 60s, it must have been a fad. They used to pour gasoline on themselves and light themselves out in public places as a sign of protest or devotion to God or something like that. And I remember in college, one of the professors said, well, what's the difference between that and what you Christians believe? And I remember my buddy who was a believer, the one who led me to the Lord, he had this brilliant insight. He says, because the word says to be a living sacrifice, not a dead one. I thought that's brilliant. It's not a physical fire God wants us to subject ourselves to, but a spiritual one. So that everything inside the skin goes up. And God's fire is the vehicle by elevating the mundane into the spiritual. That's how we come into His presence, by fire. How did Elijah come into God's presence? By a chariot of fire, right? And when you see fire, I've taught on this enough times in the past, you know, fire is always a picture of purity because it moves from the impure to the pure. But you can either give yourself to God through the spiritual fire, submitting yourself to that and allowing God to purify you and take what's in you to go up to Him, or what could have been given to God becomes dung on the earth. And which do you want? If you're trying to avoid the fire that God may have ordained for you, you think you're preserving yourself to become fertilizer, dung. There's your choices. What you want to be, a living sacrifice or dung? I mean, there's no middle ground. You're going to be one or the other. I think it's a pretty clear choice. Yes, Dale.
Didn't the Philistines leave one of the king's bones outside the gate to bleach in the sunlight, and David or somebody came along?
Yes, Saul. I believe it was Saul they did that, yes. And didn't they nail him up to the wall or something, and then David came and got him down. But yet, that was a common thing to desecrate the memory of someone, to shame someone, to leave their body exposed. Mm-hmm. I want us to dive into this study of fire for a moment and the voices, because they are very closely attached. I don't think anything, I know it's no coincidence. It's just this week I started reading a book I've had for a few months, and I saw Andy bring his copy, a copy from the library that he just finished. It's The Mystery of the Gospel, Jew and Gentile, and the Eternal Purpose of God. Now, Daniel Lancaster wrote this, and you know Daniel and Boaz will be coming here on the 11th of May. This is one of the best books I've read. I know I read a lot of books, but I don't often get that excited about any particular book. This one I'm excited about. I may have to talk to the elders about just getting a case of these and making them available so everybody can read this. It's wonderful. And you can't borrow mine, though. I'm not done with it. I was just yesterday morning. I'm always doing other reading besides what I'm preparing for Shabbat. And yesterday morning, I'm reading this chapter and thinking, well, this is exactly what Jeremiah is talking about. It's chapter 8. It's called Voices in the Thunder. So I'm going to present the outline of this chapter 2, fill in a couple things. But I want you to understand, I'm not taking credit for what I'm sharing with you at this point. This is from Daniel Lancaster. And next is chapter 6. Let's start there. In Exodus chapter 6, God makes a marriage proposal to Israel. Exodus 6. In the ancient Middle East, the way a man to propose was either he would speak with a woman, or he would send what's called the friend of the bridegroom. The friend of the groom. He would send an intermediary to carry his proposition, his proposal, to a woman. And he would say, I will be your husband, you'll be my wife. You'll be my wife, I'll be your husband. That's how the proposal is worded. And here in Exodus 6, it would help if I was in Exodus and not Leviticus. Exodus 6, in verse 7, God speaking through Moses, then I will take you from me, my people, and I will be your God. Okay? There's a proposal to them. They're in Egypt. They're in slavery. But God's coming down to say, I'm going to rescue you, but I want to marry you. I want you to be my segula, my chosen people, my peculiar people, my treasured people is what the word segula means. You know, when you skip ahead to the end of Revelation, how did the last two chapters begin? There's new heavens and new earth. God's dwelling is now with man. And you are now my people, and I'm your God. God is with his people, and the people are with God. We see the marriage consummated. And then it shows the bride descending out of heaven, you know, the New Jerusalem. So we see this proposal God is making. You'll be my wife, I'll be your husband. You'll be my people, I will be your God. And then later we come to Exodus 19, God has rescued the people. There are many illustrations and stories in rabbinical writings about a prince or a king who rescues a damsel in distress and then proposes to her and says, I've rescued you because I love you. Will you be my wife? And she says, yes, and they live happily ever after. You know, every fairy tale, every good story has that to it. Even a lot of bad stories still have that to it, have that romantic element. And that's always an echo of something's going on in the spiritual realm from the Garden of Eden until the New Jerusalem. In chapter 19, he's rescued them. They're now at Mount Sinai. And again, he speaks to them. Look at verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed hear my voice, and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you, Moses, shall speak to the sons of Israel. Moses was the friend of the groom. Now, Yeshua had a friend who is called the friend of the groom. That was John the Baptist. And, of course, you know John did most of his baptizing in the south of Israel, so that would make him John the Southern Baptist. But he was the friend of the bridegroom. He absolutely was. He said, I'm the friend of the groom. He was intermediary. And this is what Moses is. And he runs the messages back and forth between God, who's making a proposal, and the people to whom he's proposing. And then he brings the bride to the groom. And that's what Moses' job was. You look at the life of Moses and the life of John the Baptist, you'll see they had a very similar kind of ministry. Going down then to verse 8. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. Now, something very important here, and Daniel stresses this in his book, and that is this. I'll just read it, what he says, because he puts it much better than I do. He says, theologians call this seemingly unfair conundrum the scandal of particularity. In other words, why do you pick just Israel, not everybody? Call it what we will, the Bible's very clear on this point. Out of all the peoples on the earth, out of all the nations, God has entered into covenant with only one people, only one nation. That nation is Israel. God did not call the Swedes to Mount Sinai. The Irish are not a kingdom of priests. The Italians are not a holy nation. The French are not the people of God. The Americans are not the chosen people. We should go a step further and point out that God did not call the Baptists to Mount Sinai. The Catholics are not a kingdom of priests. The Lutherans are not a holy nation. The Presbyterians are not the people of God. The Evangelicals are not the chosen people. God has not made a covenant with any other people on the earth. There is no other nation born by him. If non-Jews want to be a part of the people of God, we have to leave our people and join ourselves to Israel. God has made a covenant with no other nation. This does not mean a conversion to Judaism. Do not get me wrong. What it means is you hear God's voice. What Daniel Lancaster says is the Jews do not have copyright on the Torah. The Torah was given in the wilderness because it's a no man's land, it's a land that belongs to no people. And he gave his Torah there so that anyone could come and say, Lord, I hear your voice. I want to obey you and conform my life to your will. And when you do that, you have become part of the people of Israel. Now, culturally, you may look quite different, just the way Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, they looked like Egyptians, they dressed like Egyptians, they didn't even speak Hebrew as far as I know, they spoke Egyptian. And yet, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, he took Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and adopted them, not as grandsons, but as his own sons, to make them equal with the other tribes of Israel. Equal. And Daniel Lancaster has this wonderful chapter about that. He says, now imagine how they must have been looked on by their 10 brothers. They were their uncles, and now they're their brothers. But look at these two new Israelites who eat, talk, dress, look like, sound like Egyptians. And that they are exact co-heirs. Co-heirs. Isn't that an amazing thing? But that's another whole story. That's a whole other story. Whole other story. Where then does this leave the Gentiles? Paul says that Gentiles are, quote, excluded from citizenship in Israel and foreigners to the covenants of promise, without hope and without God in the world, unquote. That's from Ephesians chapter 2. Is this fair? Perhaps not. But God is never played by the rules of men. If he desired to take a single nation for himself to the exclusion of all other nations, and that is his business, He is, after all, God. Israel alone, among all the peoples of the earth, enjoys a relationship with the Creator. If a Gentile wants to enter into covenant relationship with the God of Israel, he must enter into the nation of Israel. Another way of saying this is that if the Gentile wants to be saved, he must join the covenant God has made with Israel. How do we enter this covenant? The same way Israel entered the covenant. She entered by agreeing to hear God's voice. Yeshua invokes the Mount Sinai covenant imagery when he speaks to the Gentile inclusion. Go to John 10 for a moment. Let's turn there. John chapter 10. John chapter 10. This is this wonderful section where Yeshua refers to himself as the Good Shepherd. Start with verse 16. Yeshua is talking about the sheep, the people of Israel. But then you come to verse 16, John 10, 16. Yeshua says, I have other sheep which are not of this fold. They didn't originate in this fold. I must bring them also, and they will what? Hear my voice. Isn't that beautiful? Just the way Israel heard God's voice and became his covenant people. Yeshua says, I have other sheep who do not originate from this fold. And I must bring them also. They will hear my voice. And what will happen? They will become two flocks, one flock, it says. One flock with one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one's taken it from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. And I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. Isn't that beautiful? There is the picture where we become part of Israel, not converting to Jews, not becoming sons of Jacob, not having to necessarily adopt all the culture and the music and ethnicity of the Jewish people, but we become Israel. Let me remind you of something. When Jacob was born, he was not named Israel. At his physical birth, he was named Jacob. At his spiritual birth, when he wrestled, who I believe was Yeshua himself, the River Jabbok, and the sun came up and he realized, this is not who I thought it was. This is not my enemy. And when the angel says, let me go, Jacob says, I'm not letting you go. You bless me. And the angel says, what's your name? He says, Jacob. He says, no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. That was Jacob's spiritual rebirth. Now, you may be a child of Jacob physically, or you may not be. That's really not that important. But if you have been reborn because you've heard God's voice, and maybe you've heard it after a wrestling match with him, and he's had to put you out of joint and break you, if you've been born again, reborn from above, and that's not an evangelical term, spiritual rebirth is an ancient Jewish term. If you've been born from above, I don't care what race you're from, what nation you're from, what ethnicity you're from, you become a child of Israel. Okay? Will we all be sons of Jacob? No. Only if you are a physical descendant of Jacob. Can we all be children of Israel? Absolutely. Because he received that name at his spiritual birth. Jacob at his physical birth, Israel at his spiritual birth. We can't become sons of Jacob unless you go through a Jewish conversion, which is totally unnecessary. The scriptures are clear on this. But by hearing God's voice, you enter into this covenant he's made with Israel. And that's a spiritual rebirth. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's not complicated. Yes, go ahead, Jim.
And all that, it's still not the sacrifice that reaches the one that burned and sent the Father, but the living sacrifice of the heart. Now, with that in mind, and he cleared up one, is not the person with the right heart or the circumcised heart, though he be Jew or Gentile, Conquer hearts to be a child of God.
Okay, let me correct something you said. You said it's a sacrifice of the heart. That's a living sacrifice. That's not quite right. I understand what you're saying. But Paul says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, in mercies of God, you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, you're only going to do that if your heart's right. So it's by physical obedience. That's the works that is the proof of our faith. Okay? Because faith, without the works, without the physical expression, is dead faith. It's like the woman who sits in the chair thinking warm thoughts about her husband. She doesn't do anything for him. It's pretty useless love. And there's also a faith that's called dead faith, unless it is demonstrated by obedience to his word. So I just want to make sure we got that correction. But yes, the second part is absolutely right. It's the heart attitude of deciding I'm going to hear his voice. Remember, hearing God's voice means I'm going to obey him. I'm going to yield my life to him. He becomes my boss, not me anymore. And when you do that, you are a child of Israel because you've done exactly what God invited the children of Jacob to do, to hear his voice, to yield their lives to him. Now, this is going to come right into our next part. I think this may answer the question you brought up. So you did two things for me, Jim. You gave me a chance to get a gulp of water, and you led us right into the next thing we want to bring up from this chapter. Let's go to Exodus chapter 20. Back to Exodus again. And we'll wrap this up here very shortly. Exodus 20. Exodus chapter 20. This is the chapter where God is speaking from Mount Sinai. And the voice of the shofar, the voices of thunder, the voices of fire, they're called. And in Exodus chapter 20, verse 18, your translation probably reads something like this. All the people perceived the thunder or heard the thunder and the lightning. Right? Something like that? Let me tell you what the Hebrew says and make the corrections in your Bible. All the people saw the voices and the flames or torches. Flames or torches. Let me say it again. All the people saw the voices and the flames. 18. Exodus 20, 18. Okay? It's not thunder. There's another word for thunder. But this is the word voices, kolot. And the word for perceived is not the word shema, it's the word roe. It's the word to see, ra'ah. And the word for lightning is barak, like barak, Deborah and barak. But that's not the word used here. It's not lightning, it's flames. Okay? They saw the voices, plural, and the flames, the fiery torches, whichever word you'd like to use. And the sound of the shofar and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Well, that would be kind of weird. Could you imagine what it would be like to actually see the voice coming out of someone, to see the sounds coming out? And then you've got several voices, and you see them, and each one has its own shading and coloring. God's voice is described here as flames. And this makes some sense, because later in Deuteronomy, right there towards the end, I think it's the 33rd chapter, 31, 32, 33, right in there, where Moses is talking on behalf of God and saying how he gave his fiery law, his fiery Torah, Ishdat. Fiery law. That's kind of interesting. And but apparently, and according to the legends of the Jews and their writings, when the people were at the foot of the mountain, they could actually see the flaming sound coming forth, God's voice. They couldn't see God, but they saw his voice, and it appears waves of fire coming off of the mountain. My goodness, can you imagine such a thing? Can you imagine? And the word voices is used a number of times here in chapters 19 and 20 of Exodus. You can go back, and if you can have a good concordance and make sure you get in the right translation, you'll see the word voice appear a number of times. And here's something that's interesting. The Midrash Rabbah and the Talmud both say this, that when God's voice, as it was uttered, split into 70 voices, because it says plural voices. Why voices plural? Because what they're saying here, there's a mixed multitude. You've got Jews, of course, but you've got slaves from every part of the world. You had slaves from all over the Mediterranean, all over Africa, from all over Asia, from all over the Germanic nations. Egypt, they didn't care what nationality you were. If you could work, you were their slave. It was a mixed multitude that went out. And so the reason there were voices coming from Mount Sinai is not that there were many gods speaking, only one God, but there are many voices because each man, the Midrash Rabbah and the Talmud tells us, each man heard God speak in their own language. They say, and listen to this verse. This is an incredible verse. Jeremiah 23:29. Jeremiah 23:29 says, God speaks, "Is not my word like fire, declares the Lord? Is not my word like fire, declares the Lord, and like a hammer that breaks a rock in pieces?" You ever taken a rock and struck a steel hammer, a metal hammer against it? The sparks fly off? And they're saying that what happened when God spoke is like, it's like the fire and the sparks flew off, and every person heard God's voice in their own language. This voice of fire is not my word like fire. Yes, Valerie.
One of my Midrash questions was going to be, you said in previous weeks that everything that happened in the New Testament was pictured in the Old Testament.
Yes.
But I thought, where does it say that there's tons of fire in Acts chapter 2 that happened in the Old Testament?
Yes.
But then
that's it.
That's probably then what happened.
Exactly.
In Acts 2.
What day of the year did Exodus 20 take place? Shavuot, Pentecost. We come to Acts chapter 2. What day of the year? Shavuot, Pentecost. Shavuot, Pentecost is an ancient Jewish holiday. I shouldn't say Jewish holiday, a Moedim, where they celebrate the giving of the Torah. It was on that particular day. So what happens? There's the wind. There is the flames set up on a mountain upon individual men's heads. And the people, and it lists over 15 different countries and locations that the people come from to Jerusalem for Shavuot, and they each heard the language, their own language spoken by the apostles. Now the reason the Midrash Rabbah and the Talmud says 70 languages is because in Genesis 10, it gives us the family trees and how the nations are all broken up. And if you count all the nations, there are 70 nations listed in Genesis 10. And so you'll always see in rabbinic writings, when they're referring to the nations of the world, it's always 70. Because in Genesis 10, all of us come from one of these 70 nations. We all derive from one of these 70 ancestors. And there were 70 different languages. Apparently at Babel, when God confused the languages, he confused them according to these people groups into 70 different original languages. So let's catch this now. The people saw the voice of God, the voices, and they were as fire. Jeremiah 23:29, God speaks and says, "Is not my word like fire?" So let's put the pieces together. How is it you become a living sacrifice? What is the fire on the spiritual altar that makes your life, your very body, an ola to arise? What is God's fire? His word. His word is fire. You know, your words express the heart. Out of the fullness of the heart, you know, the mouth speaks. So that's where the issues of life come forth. And you know, the eyes are the window of the soul. When you look at someone's eyes spiritually, you can look in to see what they're made of. I mean, if you really want to kind of know what a person's feeling, you don't look at their fingernails. You don't look at their earlobes. You look in their eyes. You can tell what a person's thinking and feeling to a great degree. It's a real intangible thing, but it's very real. Well, when we have a description of Yeshua on the island of Patmos, he visits John. John turns around. He hears his voice. He turns around and describes what he sees. And when he describes Yeshua's eyes, what are they? His eyes were like fire. So when you look into the windows of Yeshua's soul, his very soul is fire. This holy heat and purity. And out of the soul, that's where the heart speaks, the mouth speaks. His word is fire. And when his word truly goes into us, our response is to run, or to submit ourselves to it, let it burn away all that needs to be burned away. And that's how we become living sacrifices. How do we hear His voice? His voice is fire. His voice is going to burn you. But let me put it this way. The true you will not be damaged by the voice, and be purified like pure gold or silver that's separated from the dross. But you have to submit to it. You must say, Lord, I hear Your voice. And what You say, I will do. I'm a living sacrifice. When a wife gives herself to her husband on her wedding day, she's giving her body to him, isn't she? I mean, I'm not going to be crass here, but what would it be like if a woman stood there at the altar and says, yes, I'll take you as my husband. You can have my money. You can have my possessions. No sex. But you know what? There are a lot of believers who have made that kind of vow to the Lord. I'll give you time when the church is open, if I feel like going. I'll give you a few minutes each morning if I'm not too busy to pray. I'll read your word when it's convenient. But only those parts that I agree with. You understand? Yeah, I'll give some money. I'll give some of my possessions to good causes. But I'm not promising you a tithe. I'm not promising you a tenth. But you know, we don't say those words with our mouths, but so many of us have done that in our hearts. And still do. I'm guilty. And but you get the picture here? I think the more I talk, the more I'm taken away at this point. Let's submit ourselves to the Word of God. His Word is fire. Let's hear His voice. And let the fire of His Word burn away the dross, the junk. So what's left is pure, and it's an olah that goes up to Him. This is our reasonable service, Paul says. Well, we have to finish with this. We didn't complete our reading of the Haftorah. When you get to chapter 8 and verse 3, the Haftorah skips over to chapter 9 and finishes with verses 23 and 24. The sages, centuries ago, they never wanted to end a Haftorah portion on a negative note. So here's our positive, upbeat note. Let's read the last two verses of our Haftorah portion. Jeremiah 9, verses 23 and 24. I love these verses. Thus says the Lord, let not a wise man boast of his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast of his might. Let not a rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts, boast of this, that he understands and knows me. That I am the Lord, who exercises loving kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth. For I delight in these things, declares the Lord. Now you've often heard me say there's no place in the Bible commands us to understand God. I still stand by that. Because the word understand that we've been looking at here the last couple of weeks, the word bina, is not the word used here. The word used here is the word sekel. Sekel. S-E-C-H-O-L is how you'd probably spell it in English. Sekel is a different word. Though we probably use the word understand to translate it, but it doesn't mean the same as bina. Sekel was first found in Genesis 3 when it says Eve saw the fruit and it was desired to make one wise. That word for desired is the word sekel. The word is very odd. It's translated a bunch of different ways into our English translations. But here's what the heart of the word is. It means to understand something just enough to want it. That's basically the simplest, roughest way I can give it to you, but in general terms, it means to understand something just enough to want it. And God says, this is what you should boast in, that you sekol me. You understand me just enough to know, this is what I want. You know, when most of us who are married, when you married that woman or you married that man, it was sekol, not bina. Bina came later, right? Sekol, you understood this enough to say, I want this person. And after years of marriage, you've heard me talk, we've been married 25 years, I'm still getting an old Robin. I still am. And I'm delighted. I have no complaints. I won't speak for her, though, on that about me. But that's what. But look at the next word. They understand and know. In Hebrew thought, to know means to become one with something. They understand enough to want me, and they become one with me. Because for a husband and wife to come together physically is called da'at, called knowledge. You see? God says, boast in that. Boast in that, that you know me at least well enough to desire me and to yield your life and become one to me, to submit to me. You can brag about that. You can brag about that. Because when you brag about that, you're not bragging about you. You're not bragging about you at all. You're bragging about the spiritual bridegroom who's loved you, rescued you, given himself for you, and has taken to you, him to himself as his segulah, his treasured people. That's something you can brag about, that he has that kind of a love and is open to others. You can be all become part of that bride if you'll just hear his voice. Did you get the picture? What a great passage. Did we finish it? Yeah, we did. Okay. I thought I saw a couple of tentative hands going up. Are there some questions or comments anybody has? This is a good place to stop? All right. Okay, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you so much for your wonderful, your incredible word. Lord, it's such an expression of love to us. And even the warnings, the parts of your word that would appear dark to us, Lord, those warnings are given out of love because you want the best for us. So, Lord, I pray you grant us enough wisdom to make decisions that are right. And Lord, again, you do not command us to understand you, but you do command us to obey you and to learn about you the best we can, to come to you, to come and reason together with you. Lord, at least that much we can do, at least to investigate your claims. And Lord, I know if we do that with an honest, truth-seeking heart, we will not be disappointed. Lord, I pray you continue to make us the segulah, the treasured people that you want us to be. Help us to see you more clearly. Help us to become more like you and reflect your glory and your light to those around us. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.